Welcome to A Moment of Bach, the first episode in a mini-series about the Brandenburg Concerto No. 6 in B-flat major. On this podcast, we take our favorite moments from Bach's vast output, just a minute's worth or even a few seconds, and show you why we think they are remarkable. Generally, we spend one episode on a different piece, but every year, we take a few weeks to go through an entire Brandenburg Concerto. And this time, it's No. 6. We are your hosts, Christian and Alex Giebert. Today's moment is from Brandenburg Concerto No. 6, Movement 1, a cello line, an independent cello part. When Bach worked at the court in Köthen, his employer was Prince Leopold, who was an amateur musician and wanted to be a part of the orchestra sometimes, and he played viola da gamba. Viola da gamba is the sort of cello-sized viol instrument that goes between the legs, much like a cello does, except it's a member of a different family, it has a different tone. There's been a few times, one of them recently, that we've talked about the viola da gamba. It's an older instrument, and by the time of Bach writing this, it was already considered at that time an antiquated instrument. We think that he most likely wrote this concerto as a chance to get Prince Leopold involved playing the viola da gamba. Although, a look at the score shows us that the viola da gamba parts are not as complicated as the viola parts. The Brandenburg Concerto No. 6 is scored for a really, really weird instrumentation, but not completely isolated in Bach's output. He's done stuff kind of like this before. Two violas, two viola da gambas, an independent cello part that's separate oftentimes from the continuo, and the bass line, the continuo. So do you know what is most strangely absent from this?
Where are the violins?
Where are the violins? The violins carry the top line, usually the top two lines of music. They usually play a prominent role. Their tone is brighter. They can generally go faster. They can go way higher. Where are they? How are you going to write a piece of music that has no violins? What happens if you want to play high? What happens if you want to play fast? Well, Bach was a violist, so he understood all the capabilities of a viola. He loved viola parts, he loved harmony, so it makes sense that he would flip things around in this way and give the two violas, essentially, a difficult part. And then maybe he wrote those viola da gamba parts to satisfy the employer, but maybe he was just interested in the really unique sound combination, sort of darker, more veiled tone of two violas and two viola da gambas, plus other bass instruments. It's a really deep sound too, because we have a lot of low instruments here.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of BWV 18, Cantata.
Is that the Reagan one? The one,
yeah, with Reagan, like, and snow. Reagan. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's four violas.
Yeah.
That's cello, so cool. Continuo. But what I find fascinating about this instrumentation specifically, really split out, it's really a group of two violas and cello, which are more similar to the modern string section type of instruments. And then there's the violas da gamba and the violon, which are the viol class instruments.
That's true.
And you could tell that he is thinking of them separately, because typically for Bach, he exists in this interesting era of music where scoring, like orchestration, is coming into its own, right? And really it's basically solidified by the time he comes along. There's a lot of interesting scoring that's already happened in the early and mid-Baroque eras. But really the idea of playing exactly to the instrument's strengths while you're scoring it is something that didn't come to its full fruition until like the Romantic era, right? Wouldn't you say, Christian?
Mm-hmm.
Like in the classical era of Mozart, which is before the Romantic era, the scoring becomes a little more discrete, I would say, with the different instrumental groups being more discrete from each other. rather than the more old-style contrapuntal stuff that Bach was doing, where a lot of the instrumental parts would be similar to even to the choral parts. They were all contrapuntal, and they all had to be similar in certain imitative ways, right? And so Bach and his cantatas, you can see that he does care about that stuff. I was just looking at BWV 80, which is something we should cover later, Christian, and noting that there's some really cool stuff. And in one of the middle movements, there's three oboes, and then there's violin 1, 2, and viola. And the way the interplay works with those is sometimes they are doubling, but other times the oboes are moving up and down while the strings are hitting all these repeated notes. And up to tempo, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's not really possible for oboes, so Bach doesn't give oboes that stuff. And he knows what he's doing with the instruments, right? That's my point. So, coming back to this, he gives the violas specifically the most facile stuff. At least, it would seem that way, but then when you look a little closer at the score, you realize that a lot of times he will place the two violas with the cello in these little imitative sections. And then there's other times where he has the two violas da gamba playing off of each other with imitative things. So he's thinking of these sections, even with the interesting limitation of not having violins, not having very high register sounds, he's still able to get so much interesting contrast out of these middle and low range instruments.
Mm-hmm. And then as history progresses, this becomes a thing that composers start doing as a tradition, like in the beginning of Requiem Masses.
Yes.
Of orchestral and choral Requiem Masses. The foray is the big one. And then after that...
Brahms.
I guess Brahms, that's first. And then foray, then Durufle after that. Mm-hmm. All beginning with their first movements having no violins in them. And their violins are used in the rest of those works. They just sit there and they don't play for the first section. You gotta love a composer who just, you can tell they just want to write occasionally for an unusual group.
Yeah.
Like, we love to see it. It reminds me of the composer, the film score composer, Bruce Broughton, who taught at UCLA, actually. He did the score for Tombstone.
Yeah.
And I think he might say this in the special features, like DVD special features, the famous like shootout scene at the OK Corral. I can't remember if it's 3 or 4, but there's a section where it's mostly just, I think, 4 bassoons.
Oh, yeah.
And like, that's just amazing because there aren't typically 4 bassoons in an orchestra. Even in a big orchestra, there's generally 2, maybe 3. And a dedicated section of music where you actually have to go out of your way to hire more or different instrumentalists. I mean, as an ex-bassoonist, if I saw that I was going to be playing something and that there were 4 independent bassoon parts, I'd think, like, what is this? Or how big is this orchestra?
Yeah.
But if the composer's point was to create a sound world that was completely separate than what we were expecting, I just think that's really cool.
Because
it's different.
Yeah. And that scene you're mentioning is like an action scene, right? But a lot of cues from horror scenes get some really interesting instrumentation out of the orchestra.
Yeah.
If the composer is even using orchestra, maybe they're using something else a little more modern instrumentation wise or whatever. But you know what I thought of when you said that? John Williams' score to the first Harry Potter film has that one track called Hogwarts Forever, and it's just a straight up French horn quartet.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's normal to have 4 horns in an orchestra, but most movie scores do not include like a section of it where you just get a nice long French horn quartet. You just don't get that very often.
No,
it's a cool, interesting choice by John Williams there.
Yeah.
And then to your point about the bassoons, the thing I always think of there for Bach is Mass in B minor, the Quoniam movement, which is the 11th movement, the first section. And that has this great instrumentation of continuo plus 2 bassoons plus a solo.
Bass solo.
Horn.
And a bass soloist.
And a bass soloist. So the voice is a bass. It's a horn, which is like in an alto-ish, tenor-ish range, basically. But then the 2 bassoons, which are kind of playing off this little thing, kind of cute.
Separate from the continuo part, because usually a bassoon, there'd be 1 bassoon playing the bass line. But in this case, the bassoon parts are written out separately.
Thank you. Yeah, so if you're going to perform the Mass in B minor, you can't get away with just one bassoon that plays with the continuo. You have to have two. And you have to have a horn player who only plays in that movement of the entire work. It's just there.
It's a little impractical, even just talking about how to program it. But yeah, that's what he wanted.
Well, and a lot of Bach works are impractical to program. This Brandenburg Concerto, for example, who's got, well, already viola da gamba is obscure. Who's got two violas, two viola da gambas, cello, and then a violone, which you could get away with a double bass nowadays, but, or that other cantata we mentioned that has four violas. It's just so weird.
It's so cool. I think a lot of violists would love to play something that's interesting, though, because generally their part is filling out some middle harmonies, and they don't necessarily have as active of a part as a violin does.
Right, same with horns. I mean, a lot of horns get saddled with just offbeats playing Sousa marches or whatever. It's got to be boring, right?
Yes,
but then something comes along like the Williams cue from the Harry Potter film, or the Bach solo, if you're really lucky, right, from the Quoniam that I mentioned earlier. Now that's what the horn players live for.
Yeah. I also love the idea of what all these weird instrumentations that we've spoken about have in common is that they're all low.
Yeah.
There are, I think, maybe less examples of only high instrumentations in this era because you got to have some kind of a bass line. It does happen, and we've spoken about a few where the continuo is relegated to an upper part, which is unusual, but it does happen.
Yeah.
But on the bass front, it's cool because it's an interesting challenge for a composer because there has to be a bass line in this style of music. But if you're going to pick a whole bunch of other essentially lower instruments, you have to work out how those are going to not interfere with or seem like they're also the bass line, or maybe doubling them at some point. Maybe they will be.
That's a great point.
And the violas, that's where the violas shine because they are high enough to stand out. This also reminds me, by the way, of the Harry Potter first movie, the Fluffy's Harp.
Oh, yeah.
It's scored for harp and contrabassoon solo, so a double bassoon, cool. And that's just a more modern instrument that's a lower bassoon.
I love that era of John Williams' scores because it's like Bach with this. It's like he's totally just experimenting with
stuff.
He's
trying new, he wants things to sound different. And these were orchestral instruments, so it's not like he was actually dipping outside the Western orchestra. He was just using combinations within the Western orchestra that are interesting, too.
Yeah. Let's go through a little bit of this first movement and talk about a few moments orchestrationally that are interesting. We start out with, as we said, the two violas having the more interesting and fast material, I guess you would say. You can hear it right off the bat. Both violas da gamba, cello and violone, are playing straight up eighth notes, just that are repeated. That's this backbone that's happening. So they're just going dun, 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 and providing this rhythmic drive for the rest of it. If you just played the viola parts by themselves without that, it would be pretty, but it wouldn't have any propulsion.
I think it would sound like you opened up two tabs in your browser if you did that, because they're in a really close canon. They actually, like, it's the first one and then a half a beat later, the second viola.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's a great example of how Bach can use something like canon that he excels at to make something beautiful that you don't even have to know is canon. Like, it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da in the viola one, and in the viola two, what is it? It's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's the same. However, it starts a half beat late, as you said. So da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, let's sing those together, yeah? I'll sing viola one, you sing viola two. Okay, should we try it?
Yeah.
Ready? It sounds like we are not doing a good job of staying together, right? But we're intentionally.
It'd be like if you tried row, row, row your boat, but instead of doing what you would normally do, which is start, I guess, four bars later
four beats
later,
like gently down. When the first person starts singing the word gently, that's when you start.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Row.
It's like if you were to just start the next person on the very next word, I think it would be a lot tighter.
I think it would still work though.
Yeah, it would.
Let's do it.
Okay.
You go first this time.
Ready? Go. Row, row, row your boat,
row your boat
gently down, gently the stream,
down the stream.
Merrily, 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 life is but a dream.
Actually, it works.
Actually, it worked perfectly.
Yeah, because of the thirds, the harmonies.
It's actually a lot like this because it's constructed in a way that if you just dislodge everything by just one beat, it still works.
Because it's pretty consonant in the tonic, you know? I think that's why it mostly works. Row, row, row your boat is like that because the whole thing is basically arpeggio or a scale, but it's like a scale that's still focusing on the tonic chord. So it's pretty simple. And this actually is pretty simple at the beginning too. It's just arpeggiating the tonic basically, a couple of little decorations. So we get past this section here with all these dun 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 in the bass. And then we get to something that has a little more interest as soon as the continuo drops out. Now what we're hearing is fast viola stuff, which is underpinned by another canon, but this canon is in the Violas da Gamba. Through this in the background. It's kind of hard to catch, but that's the Violas da Gamba. And then the continuo will come back in with the dun dun dun. So the role of the continuo is to keep the propulsion going. The cello just gets to tag along with the continuo when that happens, but then the cello gets its own role later. And here are some of my favorite stuff, and that is when the cello and the two violas get to shine, the other instruments stay silent. So you got to hear the cello get a little feature there by itself in a sort of imitative feature with the violas there. The rest of the movement just sort of plays on those ideas, but he also does introduce some dynamic interest by marking some sections piano and some sections forte. And when we get back into the tutti forte, which means everybody playing forte, there's two moments that this happens in this movement. And these are my moments for this movement because of the interpretation by Netherlands Bach Society on those moments. They do a little bit of a ritardando right before the forte. And I think it just works so nicely to set up this big sound of the forte, especially the second one, which I'll play for you here, because in the second one, it's special because the continuo isn't playing during the piano. And then suddenly when everybody's in at the forte, it makes it a big moment out of it. Then in the coda section, Bach ends it the way that he started it, which is all the instruments giving the dun 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 repetitive rhythm except for those two violas on the top. And again, they're not high range instruments, but they are definitely taking the top material here as they close us out into a beautiful cadence, landing on the B flat that we started on.
And now, here is the piano to forte moment from the Brandenburg Concerto No. 6, Movement 1. If this introduction to a musical moment has inspired you to hear the rest of Brandenburg 6, Movement 1, please see the link in the episode description. We have a wonderful recording of this by the Netherlands Bach Society that we're using for this podcast. And then stay tuned, because in the next 2 weeks we will release episodes on Brandenburg Concerto No. 6, Movements 2 and 3.
Until next time, enjoy those moments.